This is Radio Skid Row On Demand.
I have with us Mayor of Marrickville, Joe Halen.
Welcome to the program, Mr. Manu Tauri. Kia ora, morena, Manu.
The CEO, Make-A-Wish, Gerard Menzies.
Radio Skid Row On Demand.
Radio Skid Row, 88.9 FM.
Hi, I'm Jeff Furlow and you're listening to the Baby Boomer's Guide to Life in the 21st Century on Radio Skid Row 88.9 FM. The Baby Boomer's Guide to Life in the 21st Century is a weekly program for older Australians where we talk about ageing well. And every week, we'll talk about the issues that affect us as we age, right here and right now.
It happens every day.
Later in today's episode, we will be talking with John Bell of the Bell Shakespeare Company about his formative cultural experiences in a segment we call Nostalgia Town. Nostalgia Town is a weekly segment where we hear a well-known older Australian talk about their formative cultural experiences. In later episodes, we'll hear from Graham Bond of Auntie Jack fame, Australian comedian and author Jill Kitson, and Radio Skid Row's own elder statesman, Lex Marinos, who everybody remembers as Bruno from Kingswood Country and the early days of the ABC's 2JJ. After that, we'll be speaking with the Inner West Council's Healthy Ageing Program Supervisor, Mary Chanter, who's going to tell us what's on in the Inner West for older people in a segment we're going to call Out and About. But first things first, today we are going to discuss ageing, discrimination and stigma with an expert and then my two studio guests who will chew the fat with me on the punters panel. Our expert today, discrimination and stigma as we age, is Susan Ryan AO. Susan Ryan was Australia's first age discrimination commissioner within the Human Rights Commission. She was also an Australian Labor Party senator for the ACT, and she was the first woman to be a member of a federal Labor cabinet. I began by asking Susan to explain what ageism is and how older Australians are discriminated against and stigmatised.
Well, Australia is very ageist. And what that means is that as people get older, they notice that suddenly, instead of being taken seriously for whatever they are, whatever they've done, whatever they're doing, they're suddenly put in a little stereotype box called an older person. When I was at the Australian Human Rights Commission, I had conducted our first national research project into ageism, and we found that it was very widespread and it's very damaging to older people to be treated in an ageist way. The most obvious thing is that as people get into their 50s and a bit beyond, they will often lose their jobs because of ageism, or fail to get a promotion or a retraining opportunity that they will need to keep their careers going. And so it can have a profound financial impact on them. If you lose your job at, say, 58, it's very hard to get another one, regardless of what a good employer you've been and your qualifications. So that economic damage from ageism is extremely important. Then if we move along to older people, say in their 70s, they often find that they are not treated with respect or with dignity. For example, if they have a complaint with a telecommunications company or something like that, they find that they're dismissed or spoken to as if they have got brain damage. So in retailing, older people often find that they're ignored. They go into a busy shop. They don't get the attention that they need to make the purchase they were intending to make. We now have a Royal Commission into aged care, and that will focus particularly on some of the very bad things that happen in our nursing homes, but also people receive aged care in their own home, which is in principle an excellent thing. But again, it's not always delivered in a way that's respectful and helpful to the person. So they're just a few of the things.
Respectful, that seems to be the key word, isn't it?
Look, respectful is the key word. I think what people want, but what they want as they age, is respect. If they have a problem or a health issue, they would hope that they are treated respectfully while that problem is being attended to. That's often the most common complaint. They say, I go to talk about the problem and I'm not listened to, I'm not respected.
You're talking more about emotional impacts, aren't you?
That's right. A lot of older people now are single for one reason or another. If they're treated rudely, you know, by a service provider of some kind, or, you know, they can't get the bus to where they need to go to because they've got a bit of arthritis and the bus hasn't got the lower step, they can become quite depressed. And they can say, look, what's the use of doing anything? I'll just stay home, which is actually the worst thing you can do at any age, but particularly for older people, the most important thing for good emotional health is that they are out and about and connecting with other people. That there's nothing worse than being isolated and alone. I'd like to go up to the shops, or I saw that they were having something on up at the community centre there, but I just feel nervous about getting the bus, or I feel if it's crowded, people might shove me in, I'm using a walker. And so that sense, look, I can't participate anymore, that leads to very serious health consequences.
There's a lot of research about the health outcomes of people who are connected compared to those who are not.
Absolutely, and that research is very important, and I hope we see a lot more of it. When our researchers look at groups of people who age well, and there are some countries that are kind of places that are renowned for it, and if you look at how they live a community life. On the Greek island, for example, they still, you know, grow their vegetables, they still meet with their friends every day, every day.
How do older people get this from the community that they live in?
Well, I think in Australia, most people live in or around cities or suburbs. We have our regional centres, of course. I think we don't do very well in supporting older people at this stage of their life. We have a very good health system. We do have the age pension, which in itself is very important. We have some of the big things right, but we don't have this community connectedness thing right. We don't plan for it. Our local councils do a reasonable job, but they don't. I don't think they focus on it nearly enough. And we have a lot of issues in a busy suburb like the one I live in around safety and crossing the roads and getting on buses and so on. None of the way things are set up seems to take account of the fact that, look, you can't always scurry across the road in the few seconds that you get if you get a green light on a busy highway. Or, as I said, if you are getting the buses need to have that lower stair because not everyone can hike up what seems to me to be about, you know, a 2-foot step to get on, or they take a bit longer to get on and off. Now, I have to say, the bus drivers, in my experience, are very good and very helpful. But often the vehicle is badly designed, there's a rush, the buses are lining up, the driver's under pressure to take off. Now, it sounds like a pretty practical thing to fix up, but if you don't feel you can go down and get on the bus and go up to a shopping centre or see your doctor or see your friends, then that's when you start to get isolation. And I think Australia, generally speaking, does not do this sort of connectedness support well at all. Well, and I think it does come down to us as a community and our community values. I would like to see more recognition of the value of older people, respect for older people, and just more thought if an organiser's putting on an event thing. Well, we hope some of the older people turn up to this concert down in the park or something. So if they do, we'll need to have a few chairs where they make sure there's shaded areas. For older people, it can be quite physically distressing if they're standing in the heat, if there's nowhere to sit down, if there's no shaded area. Just those sorts of things would make it much easier for our older people to connect with the community. And I know some councils have made a very big effort, but I do know others pay a bit of lip service and don't do much. So it shouldn't just be a lucky dip. As in every other thing in life, I do think we each have a responsibility ourselves to treat other people well, but also to take steps to make sure that we're in a good frame of mind. We need to look after our own health. We need to take some exercise every day. We need to eat healthily. We need to make an effort to do things, you know, something, oh, I'd like to go to that, but I can't be bothered. Well, go. You know, we have agency. We should remind ourselves of the many positive aspects of being an older person, and there are plenty of those. As you get older, certainly there's a bit of a physical deterioration. But on the other hand, I think you've lived a long life, you've had your ups and downs, you become very aware and intelligent about society and people. I think in your older years, you are a much better judge of character. You can be more patient when things go wrong. It seems you're going through a terrible time. I like to say, this situation won't last. So you get that sense as an older person. Look, things can go badly, but then they can be rebuilt. And speaking personally, I think that's a terrific understanding to have.
You're talking about wisdom.
Yes, I suppose I am.
So we are, as we age, we are an asset to the community.
Oh, absolutely. I've spoken about the challenges facing older people in our society, but on the other hand, it's also true to say that many older people are making a fantastic contribution to their communities through volunteering, through supporting, you know, local kids' clubs, visiting hospitals, all those sorts of things. They're absolutely wonderful. And also within families. I mean, we have the situation in Australia these days that most families with children have both parents working, which means that there's much more call for grandparents or other older members of the family to step in. And I think many families would be lost without their older family member. And some grandparents now are doing virtually full-time childcare or after-school care, or step in when there's an emergency with an illness or something like that.
Hello, this is Graham Bond, and you're listening to the Baby Boomer's Guide to Life in the 21st Century on Radio Skid Row and online. So get connected and stay connected.
The owner's just a Viking. He is very
We're listening to Australia's first Age Discrimination Commissioner, Susan Ryan, speak about ageism, discrimination and stigma, and about how older Australians sometimes find themselves stepping in to care for their grandchildren. I asked Susan if that doesn't put an extra burden on older Australians who are looking forward to a quieter life. This is how she answered.
Well, look, it certainly does, but you hear different opinions about that from the older people themselves. Some of them say, I love it. I would look after my grandchildren every day. I'm not required to, but I would. I love it. I love being with them. I love making the contribution. On the other hand, you do hear some older people saying, oh, I've reared a big family myself and I'm pretty tired. And, you know, when I get kind of endless requests to help, I sometimes feel it's a bit too much. Now, you get both. It probably comes down to your own physical and mental health. If you're feeling pretty good, you really like to make this contribution. Many of us do, and it would just be good to have a bit more recognition of it.
You did mention that it is somewhat a function of your mental health. And if you're isolated already, you're more prone to be depressed. And if you're more likely to be depressed, then making the effort for connections becomes impaired. How do we overcome that?
Well, I think we need to take some positive steps. While I would like to think that older people have agency and can decide themselves to do something, I know that if they've got into a bit of a depression spiral, that's not going to happen. So I think as a community, we need to take positive steps. Special measures, local councils, local community organisations should, you know, have a grandparents' day, you know, an older person's day. They should never assume that the only people who are going to come to their club or attend their functions are the under 30s. Just be very conscious of it and invite older people. Invite them in ways that older people are used to. For example, shopping centres. Now, there's a small shopping village in my suburb. Now, there is a community notice board there, but I think it's a bit scrappy, and I think a lot more effort could be made to say, look, what's on in this suburb this week that's free, that's easy to get to? People of all ages welcome. I mean, I could go on forever about government policies and housing assistance and more aged care packages, all of those things. That's on one level. But I think how a person feels in themselves has a lot to do with how they're getting on in their own community. If you walk down the street and no one looks at you, no one smiles. I mean, I've got a policy myself when I walk down the beach most days. I just smile and say good morning to people. Now, some people might think that's, you know, uncalled for. But you'd be surprised how many people smile back. And you just say it's a nice day or, goodness, you know, it looks like we're going to get some rain. Just those normal interactions, which if you're an old person living alone, you really miss. And so I think if the whole community is aware, or if an older person's going up the stairs and having a bit of trouble, say, do you need any assistance on and off buses, in shops, if an older person's wheeling their trolley around and maybe it's a bit slower than the very busy 32-year-old mum of two, she should think, well, look, that could be my mother. You know, I don't have to hurry up, hurry up. Just things like that. I mean, what I'm talking about is normal human kindness. It doesn't take a big effort, but if you don't have it, the older person who is feeling a bit depressed can get more depressed. So I've said it's on community organisations, businesses, events organisers to do things. Make clear that older people are invited, welcome and catered for. But it's also on all of us.
Recently there's been a lot in the news, a lot of research indicating that we're having a bit of an epidemic of loneliness and isolation. And in the United Kingdom, they have a ministry for loneliness.
The great thing when I heard about the UK appointing a Minister for Loneliness, I thought, well, that's terrific. I don't know what that minister will actually do, what sort of programs he or she will have, how many resources. That's another question. But even naming a person with that portfolio responsibility raises awareness. People say, oh, what's that for? We don't need it. Do we need it? Perhaps we do need it. So I think here we could follow that path, or we could do what I constantly exhort our political leaders to do, on both sides whenever I see them, and say, when you're talking, make sure you're addressing older Australians as well as families. There's an absolute focus on families, particularly families with kids. We can all understand why. On the other hand, when I get and hear a politician say, we're going to do this for families and children, we're going to do that for families and children, I say, well, look, yeah, and say, and older Australians too. A very large number of people turn 65 every day. And that number, whatever it is getting bigger every day. And thanks to our great medical services and advances and so forth, many of the people who turn 65 today will live to be 100. Now, we haven't all cottoned onto that. People still think 65, oh, well, it's downhill. It's not. You might have another 25 years, 30 years even to live. And so you have to think, well, how am I going to live this? What do I want to do for the next 30 years? And society, government, service providers all have to think too. Well, this person's only 66. Perhaps I will advise them to go and do a training course so that they can perhaps get a part-time job or they can work as a volunteer.
There's probably something about the cohort that are ageing now. We have a bit of a habit of shaking the tree.
Well, that's right, and I hope that that habit manifests itself in old age. I don't like generational wars, you know. I don't like those public conversations that go, oh, well, older people had everything and now we can't get our houses and we've got a huge debt so we go to university. I don't think they're very helpful. I think it's best to say, well, look, but look, the baby boomers, the post-Second World generation, did have many things that worked out for them, but they made some of those things happen. I mean, I was a feminist in the early 70s. I am a feminist. But we started things that if we don't do it, it won't happen. So we had a very clear sense that the laws had to change to prevent discrimination against women, to provide childcare, to provide women's refuges, to provide reproductive health and choices. If we didn't do it, no one else is going to do it. That's still my view. And I would like to see more activism amongst the baby boomers as they leave their paid work. You know, there's the seniors organisations and so on, and they're good, but they're not like mass movements. I would like to see a lot more organised action around things that we can do to make life fairer and better for people as they age.
Resistance with a walking stick.
Well, absolutely. A walker, a walking stick, you know, if it helps you, grab it.
What are the key messages, Susan, you would like to send to older Australians about ageism, discrimination and stigma as they age?
Well, my message to older people who are experiencing ageism is don't accept it. Don't accept that, well, that's the way society sees me, so I'll just have to go along with it. Say, no, that perception's wrong. I am active. I do want to contribute. I do deserve proper and respectful treatment when I'm purchasing something or getting a service, and stand up for yourself.
One more question. Do you think ageing can be fun?
Oh, it certainly can be, because you've got so many memories that are good memories, and you've got so many insights into how things are. I think you can have a lot of fun going down memory lane and remembering some of the mad and fun things you used to do, but also the freedom of saying, look, let's just go and do this thing, or go and see a silly movie, or go to a concert that we would never have gone to when we were younger, but that we've always wanted to hear. There's some, you know,
heavy metal,
if that's what, yeah. And just, look, we know that everyone else there will be young enough to be our grandchildren, but let's just go. And get a group of buddies and off you go. It can be huge fun. You're not self-conscious. You know, when you're a teenager or even a young adult, other people's opinions of you can oppress you. Oh, I've got to do this because people expect it. I've got to look this way because people expect it. You know, when you're in your 70s and 80s, you're beyond that. So you just say, look, I want to wear this, or I want to go to this heavy metal concert. And as I said, I don't care if I'm the only 80-year-old there. I'm going to have fun.
So, Susan Ryan, give me some of your favourite sentimental songs or nostalgic songs that tell me a little bit about you.
Oh, well, I was a beach girl, and I can remember being down on Maroubra Beach when I was about 15, and Johnny O'Keefe turned up. Rock and roll was very new to us then. It was something we saw on television from America, which was also a rare experience. And Johnny O'Keefe turned up in a gold lamé suit and sang this song, Shout. And it really was. The whole beach just gravitated around him, and we're all jumping up and down and shouting. I'd never done anything as a good, you know, convent girl. I'd never gone on like that in my life. But it was fantastic. And that sort of exciting music was great. And it was there on our own beach. We didn't have to go to America. I mean, it was there. And again, with little Patty, when she came along with stomping at Maroubra and so on, she was a local girl. And imagine hearing a rock song with your own suburb's name in it. Like, that was hugely exciting, and we just loved it.
It was, I'm sure, terrific fun. I want to thank you very much, Susan Ryan, for speaking to me today on Baby Boomer's Guide to Life in the 21st Century.
And now, that's what we're going to have to do, is imagine Susan Ryan dancing away on the sand at Maroubra Beach. That was Little Paddy and Stompin' at Maroubra. And that was our very special guest, Susan Ryan, Australia's first Age Discrimination Commissioner. And now it's time for the Punters Panel, where we speak with local older people about the issue of the day. And the Punters panel today, in the studio with me today, first of all, we have Beverly Baker, a resident of Redfern. And Beverly, I understand you're the chair of the Older Women's Network, New South Wales.
I have that honour at the moment, yes.
And the other guest that we have today is my very handsome brother, Joseph Forlow, a 64-year-old gentleman from right here in Marrickville. We've just been listening to Susan Ryan talking about ageing, discrimination and stigma as we age. I want to ask you both, have you discovered that you're becoming invisible?
Yes, but a lot of people feel the same way. I think that our service people are really, really busy, and take the person who looks like is going to cause them the most angst rather than and step over people who don't look like they're going to be much of a danger. In terms of being invisible, you make yourself visible, really. You know, you're being abused if you're being treated rudely. You say, excuse me, please don't treat me like that.
That's certainly what Susan Ryan says. What about you, Joe?
I don't know if I'd say invisible. I'd say ignored. because people are visible, but people's eyes glaze over and their mind drifts off as you might start sharing something. As, oh, that's boring. It's coming from an old person. And you tend to... So I see it as ignored, blotted out. I suppose invisible is a fair enough thing, but it's also just something that people make an assumption, and I suppose it could well be a stereotyping or a stigma, that there's nothing here, just move on. So,
but didn't we do that when we were young as well? I mean, I can remember my grandfather giving me this talk about what it was like in the war and thinking, really? I mean, that's all then, this is now. The thing that fascinates me the most now, though, is that the things that we are being deliberately set up, it's a political decision to create ageism. The whole idea that baby boomers are rotten thieves and have stolen everything and it's all our fault that the young people can't get anything, the number of people that are swallowing that rhetoric is quite alarming. In fact, I was referred to as a good baby boomer as opposed to a bad baby boomer.
I wouldn't know whether that was insulting or flattering.
Well, I'm still trying to work that out. But the thing is that baby boomers aren't bad. Baby boomers are a generation. It's a huge generation. It's 20 years. The things that my end of the baby boomer fought for were picked up and benefited at the bottom end of the baby boomer. I didn't get free education. I didn't get free university. I struggled for superannuation, didn't come in until it was 1992. The things that we fought for were in place by the time I was in my 30s, which was in time for my younger brother and sister to benefit from those, certainly not from my benefit. We are now also told that baby boomers have got so much that really we can't afford to pay them the pension and they should sell their homes to pay for the pension. Now, for me, that's frightening. I'm 69, I still have a mortgage. I'm paying that off. The idea that at some stage between now and when I finally retire, I'm going to have to mortgage my house to get a pension that I have spent my entire working life paying for is really quite frightening and is unjust, because it's not the bulk of the baby boomers who are getting the rort that is the franking credits. That's less than 12% of the managed super funds. If we have super, which for me, working woman part-time, don't have a lot of, we didn't get that till... It's not going to be enough for me to live on. I'm going to have to get it supplemented by the pension.
You got anything to add there, Joe?
I understand a bit more when you said, you know, our eyes glazed over the oldies, but I suppose also they fought for stuff that they would say that we benefited from. And certainly... you know, I think it was most, you could say too, there was a little bit of an ignorance on our side not to appreciate what was, what those old people had to say and to do for us. But certainly I agree with you that there is a prejudice that, you're all right, you're going to manage. And yes, I think there is an element where we've got the best of things. Conditions have changed, certainly. I mean, you won't see a defined superannuation benefit anymore, but that was around in our day. So certainly things are got harder, but at the same time, there are ongoing difficulties and new challenges that we have to face that people before us haven't. And so there is this cut out for us as well.
Now you both talked about the way in which it seems like every generation abuses the old of the previous. And when I'm talking about aging, I mean anybody over 55. And this program is for anybody over 55. But Susan Ryan was talking about how in some societies there seems to be an inbuilt regard for older people, and her conclusion was that that's absent here in Australia, or it doesn't exist to quite the extent it does elsewhere. Anything to...
Well, it doesn't exist in the settled or the invaded culture, but in Aboriginal culture it is certainly there. The elders are called elders. It's not a title bestowed, it's earned because of the knowledge and the value that they have for their communities. They are the repository of the culture and the information, and that's respected. It doesn't mean that they aren't, you know, people don't still raise their eyebrows and go, oh, really, Gran? But that is a cultural thing that we do not have. Old people are meant really to be quiet and let all the work and energy be done by young people, even though human beings live to the age that they do, because old people take on some of the heavy burden of child rearing and working with young people and the next generation to get those things happening.
Yeah, you make a really good point about the Indigenous culture, because for me that's, you know, we opening ourselves up more to the influence of the Indigenous culture, even having the acknowledgement to country, it's going to be good for older people because, as you say, there is that culture and that might help change our own culture. But the more we acknowledge the Indigenous culture, then the more we're going to have the opportunities for acknowledgement and respect of elders amongst ourselves. But I think it's also true that we do lack a lot of cultural supports, but also social and economic and legislative. I had the opportunity to work in France, and the company I worked for, I'm not sure if it was legislated, but certainly they had signed up for it. They were required to recruit a certain number of people over 50, over 60, plus in terms of HR, according to your age, you were eligible to other programs that weren't available to other people.
And we certainly don't do that here.
We don't. Yeah. And I think they're practical things that can make a difference. So even being part of a mentoring program where you'd sign up to be able to help some younger person in the company. Okay.
Keep going. Indeed.
Just especially when you're talking about politicians lifting the retirement age to 70. Mm. If you are struggling to get a job when you hit 50, you are sitting on that wretched New Start and all of the hideous provisions of that that make you feel subhuman, less than a real person, for 20 years. I mean, really and truly, let's wake up to this.
Yeah,
the jobs aren't there. There's got to be some huge changes.
I mean, look, once people see the economic benefit of getting older people engaged, and it's like renewable, suddenly the tide has turned and people can see the economics of it. It's not just altruism that's driving big investment in it. There's going to be money in this. It's the same with older people. Once the resource is well utilised, well understood and rolled out, then yes, there'll be stuff. But as for feminism, you have to fight for it and you have to make the opportunities and possibilities visible.
And we're the ones to do the fighting.
Oh, yeah. I've got my walking stick and pitchfork.
Well, I think we join with young folk because the young folk are the ones that are going to benefit from them. I think we have got a lot more in common with our sons and daughters, but our grandchildren.
Yes, definitely.
We've got a lot more in common than anyone else has. They're struggling to find places to rent. They're struggling to find homes to buy. They're struggling to find work. They're struggling the same way as older people are struggling. And it's not a them and us. If we join together, that would unleash a potential that would be awesome. So I'm going after young people.
And you too, Joe?
Yes, but at the same time, I think we need to do our part.
Okie doke. Joseph Furillo and Beverly Baker, thank you for joining us today on the Punters Panel. And now for the segment of the show that we call Nostalgia Town, where we talk to well-known older Australians about the musical, the theatrical and the film experiences that helped make them the people they are today.
You must remember this. A kiss is still a kiss. A sigh.
Our guest today on Nostalgia Town is John Bell. John Bell, AO and OBE, is an Australian actor, theatre director, and theatre manager. He's been a major influence on the development of Australian theatre since, well, the late 60s. Is that not right, John?
That's correct, Jeff. Very nice to talk to you.
You worked at the Old Tote Theatre. You spent 5 years with the Royal Shakespeare Company. And in the 70s, you taught at NIDA. You will be performing in The Miser at the Sydney Opera House in March to April. John, what were your formative cultural experiences?
Well, Jeff, I grew up in Maitland in the Hunter Valley, and it was not a great cultural hub, I must say, in those days. But from a very early age, I was taken to the theatre and the movies by my mother and my grandmother and my aunts. So my earliest memories of theatre are the Sawley's Travelling Tent Show with a wonderful actor named Bobby LeBrun, who played the pantomime dame in the pantomimes in the afternoon, and in the evenings he would don the bow tie and glittery jacket and be the MC for the cabaret. He was my first hero. From the age of about 4 or 5, I was taken to see every pantomime that he was in, playing the dame. And I remember all those routines and the slapstick and the gags right to today. He was a great influence on me. A little later, my grandmother used to take me to the cinema to see every pirate and cowboy movie that came to town. She hated them. She didn't like violence, but she sat through them for my sake. And so I saw a lot of movies little boys like to see. Really, it was when I went to high school in Maitland to the Marist Brothers that I discovered literature and Shakespeare, and that has been the formative influence on my life. I had two wonderful English teachers. They both loved theatre and poetry and literature and, above all, Shakespeare, and they encouraged me in my ambition to be an actor, and without them I wouldn't have got to where I am today. So I'm very grateful for the education they gave me and for the introduction to Shakespeare above everything else. They took us off to the cinema to see Laurence Olivier's movies of Hamlet and Henry V and Richard III, plus any live show that came to town with the Elizabethan Theatre Trust. And so to see Shakespeare live on stage and then on the screen, that shaped my life. And I vowed at the age of 14, I'm going to be an actor and I'm going to play Shakespeare for the rest of my life, which is virtually what I've done. And I've found Shakespeare to be the great artistic influence, and I'd say spiritual influence, on my life ever since. I wasn't all that wrapped in pop music, but when I went to university, then I discovered classical music, and I became very, very keen on classical music and opera, which again has been one of the great loves of my life, and I'm a great collector of classical recordings. And of course, I have directed 3 operas for Opera Australia. I've done Madame Butterfly and Tosca and Carmen, which I really thoroughly enjoyed being part of those productions, part of the opera world. It's very different to any other world I've been in, but the scale of it and the excitement of hearing those great voices is unsurpassable. Classical music's been my other great joy throughout my life.
And you would have seen a great deal of change in theatre in the years that you've been involved.
I think the arts have changed a lot from when I was growing up. For one thing, there was not much Australian theatre happening. We had an occasional hit like The Summer of the 17th Doll, but they were very rare. Most of the theatre was imported. We were doing classical plays or the latest plays from the West End or Broadway, but there wasn't much in the way of Australian theatre. So when I came back from England, where I'd spent 5 years with the Royal Shakespeare Company, I taught at NIDA for a year, and then I established with a friend, Ken Haller, we established the Nimrod Theatre in Sydney, which I ran for 14 years, and that was largely to encourage new Australian writing. And we produced over 100 Australian plays, people like David Williamson and John Romerill and Alex Buzo. A lot of great Australian plays come out of that era. So my two great passions from my 30s onward have been classical theatre, Shakespeare on the one hand, and encouraging new Australian writing, new Australian theatre. So I've done a lot of Australian plays and musicals, etc., as well as the classical side, and I find the balance between those two things very, very fulfilling. Well, David Williams has been one of the great icons of Australian theatre since the 1970s. He started working with the Pram Factory and La Mama in Melbourne. Actually, I saw one of his plays, The Removalists, in Melbourne, and I brought that to Sydney and put it on at the Nimrod Theatre in King's Cross, and then it went off on a national tour, then it went overseas, and then it was made into a movie. And David and I are still very, very close friends. And he's written over 80 plays now, and every year the Ensemble Theatre in Sydney does his latest play. but of course he's written screenplays for so many movies and so much theatre. He's probably been the biggest money earner for theatre companies. He's really bankrolled the Sydney Theatre Company for a good 12 years, I would say.
You mentioned there the Summer of the 17th Dollar, which was probably regarded as one of Australia's first major theatrical events. But then we know that it was made into a film where the leads were played by American actors. That must have been very galling.
That was a dreadful thing. Still, I would say, the greatest Australian play. It's a timeless piece, and it's a wonderful play. It still resonates. And to see it turn into a movie with all American or English actors putting on fake Australian accents was insufferable. Of course, that could never happen now. We have our own film industry, and there's no way you'd get a Hollywood or English actor to play those great Australian roles. So we have come of age. I think it all started in the theatre, the Pram Factory in Melbourne, the Nimrod in Sydney, where all the new plays came from. And they, in turn, influenced our television industry.